us to this edition of the Hagmann and Hagmann Report. HagmannReport.com, that's our website. Certainly check that every day. Also, folks, just to let you know, HomelandSecurityUS.com, I'm bringing that back. Regathering of investigators, covert surveillance operatives for the Northeast Intelligence Network, infiltrating the seditious groups, I term them seditious, here in the United States, Organizing for Action, refusefascism.org, and other groups. I'm not going to get into all of them, but making their way through and into these groups. So keep your eye on that. I'll be giving you more information about that as well. Also, folks, if you're listening to this via BTR, Global Star, regardless of the venue, Global Star Radio Network, thank you so much for carrying our program, BTR as well. Please, nonetheless, subscribe to our YouTube channel. That, even with the censorship that's going on today, you have to understand with the censorship that's going on today. Let me tell you something. It is so important, to get those numbers up. And we've got, you know, last month alone, we had, close to 2 million downloads just on one platform alone of our program. And they're messing with the numbers. So look, help us out through this fog of censorship that we're seeing here. And of course, the people who don't want us to broadcast or to, you know, attain certain levels are messing with the numbers. And you see this, you know this, and there's censorship galore taking place. But anyway, and also, again, subscribe to our channel and bookmark our website. But our next guest here, this guest that we have with us, Mr. Michael Cutler, visit michaelcutler.net. michaelcutler.net.
What was that?
Yeah.
BD. michaelcutler.net. That's michaelcutler.net. And I spoke with Michael before the show, and he's a former INS agent, and so much more. He has his own radio show, The Michael Cutler Hour, on Blog Talk Radio Friday evenings at 7 p.m. And we'll bring him on so he can explain a little bit more about his background and what he came on to talk about. Mr. Cutler, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for having me on, Doug. It's great to be with you. You know, I was an INS agent for 30 years, and my career with the INS began, I hate to admit how long ago, back in 1971. I was an immigration inspector initially, and are you able to hear me okay, by the way?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure. And so I started as an inspector at Kennedy Airport. I spent 4 years doing that. Then I wound up doing 1 year as an examiner, or what we now call an adjudications officer, doing the marriage interviews. And then finally, in 1975, I became a special agent and rotated through all the squads within the investigations branch. I became the first immigration agent in New York City to be assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. In 1991, I was promoted to senior special agent and assigned to the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, had desks at the FBI, DEA, ATF. I've worked with foreign governments, including Great Britain, Canada, Israel, Japan, and others. And I came to the realization through my career that immigration and national security are inextricably intertwined. You know, when you stop and think about it, the mission of America's military, no matter which branch, is to keep the enemies of America as far from our shores as possible. Up close and in person, the job of defending us against the entry of the bad actors, terrorists, spies, international criminals, falls to the Border Patrol, and then behind the Border Patrol are the special agents who do enforcement of the immigration laws from within the interior of the United States. And I've arrested terrorists in my career. My very first solo case, I was assigned to the frauds unit. We had a young man come into Kennedy International Airport in 1976 with an altered visa. Long story short, playing a hunch, it was supposed to be a ground ball, nothing investigation. It led to the prevention of a terror attack at an Israeli oil refinery. Working with the FBI, working with the Israelis, we stopped the attack. So when people say, well, we're just going to go after criminal aliens, That's short-sighted. Unofficially, I worked with Senator Al D'Amato back in the early 80s to create what became the aggravated felon reentry law that makes reentry by criminal aliens after they're deported a felony with up to 20 years in jail. And I told the senator back then, while we need to emphasize criminal aliens, because let's face it, law enforcement is a triage. You go after the most obvious, serious issues first. Don't ignore the collateral arrests, because we don't know who the bad guys are. You know, we used to hear a lot about sleeper agents. There was a lot of terminology that kind of disappeared from the conversation on immigration, especially when Mr. Obama took office. But please understand that the presidents who've come to the Oval Office from both parties, at least since I started working for the INS, were globalists. Jimmy Carter insisted that we stop using the term illegal alien to describe illegal aliens. He said that we were going to call them undocumented immigrants. The term alien is a legal term. It simply means any person, not a citizen or national of the United States. That's not my definition. That's the definition in the law. There's no insult there, but there is clarity. And when you're a con artist, they don't want clarity. They want to use murky language that obfuscates the truth and confounds understanding. He also ordered immigration agents, that is to say Jimmy Carter, to not make arrests of illegal aliens during the census. We quickly realized what he was up to. We knew that the great majority of illegal aliens at the time were living in population centers that were predominantly Democrats. And by the way, I'm registered as a Democrat. I can't tell you the last time I voted for a Democrat. But this isn't a left-right issue, it's a right-wrong issue. And it infuriated us because he was essentially gerrymandering seats in the House of Representatives through non-enforcement of immigration law. And it also wound up shifting how many electoral votes would be in play for Democrats versus Republicans during the next presidential elections. And then along comes Ronald Reagan, who gives us the first amnesty, did not provide more agents for Interior Enforcement, which has always been the missing a link to the whole deal. And in fact, when I testified before Congress, and I've been before, I think we're up to 17 congressional hearings, and I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission, I talked about what I call the Immigration Enforcement Tripod. And I said that the third leg of the tripod, you know, the Border Patrol enforces the law between ports of entry, the inspectors enforce the law at ports of entry, but it's the Interior Enforcement mission that has been neglected. So anybody getting past that inspector at an airport, anybody getting past the Border Patrol was basically home free. When I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee in 2013, my most recent appearance before a hearing, I said that the policies of the Obama administration had, in essence, fired the starter's pistol for aspiring illegal aliens from around the world. And for those folks, the finish line was the border of the United States. Because once they got past the border, problems solved for them. Problems just began for us. And so Reagan did not hire more INS agents, actually included a confidentiality clause in the amnesty that accompanied the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 86 that gave us that amnesty. We as immigration agents could not share the amnesty files with any other law enforcement agencies, whether it was the FBI or local homicide detectives, without a court order. If you had made that disclosure without a court order, you were committing a 5-year felony. So understand that both sides of the aisle have been determined for decades to flood America with cheap foreign labor. And by the way, not just the illegals doing the difficult, dirty manual labor jobs, but you're seeing it with H-1B visas displacing American high-tech workers, which leads to security issues, which leads to the destruction of the middle class. Alan Greenspan, in point of fact, testified for Chuck Schumer back on April 30th, 2009, at a hearing about comprehensive reform, and said that we had to do what Bill Gates has been pushing for, greatly increase the number of high-tech visas, the H-1B visas, because he claimed that if we did that, we could eliminate the wage premium. I kid you not, the wage premium being paid to Americans with high skills, and by doing that through competition with foreign workers, we would greatly reduce wage inequality between Americans with skills and those with lesser skills. And the notion that you have the former chairman of the Fed making those assertions and making that recommendation and referring to American high-tech workers as the privileged elite, And on the other hand, when he spoke about the influx of illegal aliens doing the bottom jobs, he said it would only minimally suppress wages. Well, if you're working poor, how much money a month do you have to lose for you to lose your grip on having an apartment to live in? How many people became homeless when the wage suppression, because of competition by illegal immigration, drove their wages through the floorboards or even threw them out of work when employers who were unscrupulous decided that if they could hire illegal aliens, they wouldn't have to worry about paying all sorts of other fees, they wouldn't have to worry about taxes, they wouldn't have to worry about standards and working conditions. This has been exploitive. This isn't about the American dream. This isn't about compassion. This is about the engineered destruction of the wage structure of Americans, and it has endangered our national security. And all of this, by the way, flies in the face of the findings and recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. But don't let that get in the way of the greed that we are seeing from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, from the American Immigration Lawyers Association, from a long list of players who only care about profit no matter what the cost is. And the cost, of course, that we've paid have been the terrorist attacks, the massive influx of gangs, narcotics, transnational criminals, the outflow of hundreds of billions of dollars annually in remittances, money being wired home by workers, both legal and illegal. We're paying a hell of a price. And that is why I really believe that when Donald Trump came along, the politicians from both political parties had a cow. Because, you see, I don't believe it's about Democrat or Republican. Today, the debate is truly about populist versus globalist. And if you think about the Founding Fathers and Thomas Jefferson, the Declaration of Independence begins with those three magic words, we the people. That was a declaration of populism. And when was the last time we had a populist in the Oval Office?
Good point.
How's that for putting it in perspective?
Quite the perspective, indeed. You know, kind of related, but maybe somewhat tangential. I was looking at some, I was doing some research, and I came across today the statistics with a federal prison, Bureau of Prisons, looking at the inmate population, of course, 187,000 plus, roughly, of inmates, and 22%. Approximately 22% are non-U.S. citizens.
That's it might be higher. It might be higher.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking that because there's a lot of others. Yeah, anyway, yeah.
I've seen numbers that run around 30%. And, you know, when I was assigned to DEA intelligence, one of the things I did back in 1988, because I was the first guy to have that assignment. And, you know, when you're the first, you get to kind of mold the job a little bit the way you might want to. And so I decided that while I was there to assist with narcotics investigations of major trafficking organizations, I wanted to know who we were arresting. And you know, there's that sage advice of be careful what you wish for, you might get it. Well, I had asked my boss up at DEA if they could get me a copy of all the arrest records. Now, back then, in 1988, we didn't have computers and spreadsheets. And I remember for about a week, nothing happened, and I was wondering if they forgot about my request. And I walked into my office, and it was like a big squad area, if you could imagine an office building with open areas. Sitting opposite me were two FBI agents, a member of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, people from ATF, people from U.S. Customs, people from the IRS, obviously DEA, city police, state police. It was an amazing opportunity to work with so many agencies, and everybody was literally within arm's reach. And I walk into my office, and I can't find my desk. Because in front of my desk, next to my desk, behind my desk, under my desk, on top of my desk, and on top of my chair were boxes filled with arrest reports. Up to the ceiling, literally. And as I'm standing there with my mouth hanging open, some of the clerks from the file room with hand trucks were bringing in more boxes with more arrest reports. And everybody in the office was on the floor laughing. They said, you asked for it, you got it. And it took me about 4 months to dig through all that paperwork with a handheld calculator. And as I'm doing this, they're bringing me more boxes. It's like shoveling against the tide. So after 3 or 4 months, I came up with the numbers, and they blew me out of my chair. In New York City, the five boroughs of New York, roughly 60% of the people we were arresting for drug-related crimes at the DEA task force. So this isn't people selling a joint. These are significant drug trafficking crimes. 60% were foreign-born, and not just from Latin America. Asia, the Caribbean, Europe, the Middle East, you name it, we got it. Nationally, it was about 30%. So this is a huge number. And that, again, points out the nexus between borders, immigration, terrorism, crime, narcotics. It's the intersection of everything that would concern people. And what's so significant, and you know, we really should look at this, the 9/11 Commission was put together with the intention, obviously, of trying to make certain that we would not get hit again. And so, you know, you look at what the 9/11 Commission had to say. And by the way, I don't know if you remember this, but 6 months almost to the day after 9/11, it was discovered to everybody's horror that two of the dead terrorists, Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, two of the dead terrorists, had been provided with authorization to attend flight school. Atta, in fact, was the ringleader. So understand that immigration was always identified as an issue. And then within a few years, everyone downplayed it. And the Democrats in particular immediately started to say things like immigration and terrorism have nothing to do with each other. So let me start out. I just want to read a couple of quick quotes. This comes from the preface of the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. This is an official government report published by the government printing office, written by the attorneys and special agents who worked with the 9/11 Commission. And it's the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. It starts out with this preface. It is perhaps obvious to state that terrorists cannot plan and carry out attacks in the United States if they are unable to enter the country. Yet prior to September 11, while there were efforts to enhance border security, no agency of the U.S. government thought of border security as a tool in the counterterrorism arsenal. Indeed, even after 19 hijackers demonstrated the relative ease of obtaining a U.S. visa and gaining admission into the United States, border security still is not considered a cornerstone of national security policy. We believe, for reasons that we discuss in the following pages, that it must be made one. So right off the top, you could see that the commission looked at the situation and said, first and foremost, the failure of immigration enabled the terrorists to enter the country, enabled them to embed themselves, hide in plain sight. Now, to put this into perspective, because this is really important, this was not something that could not have been figured out in advance. On May 20th, 1997, I did my very first hearing as an expert witness before the House Immigration Subcommittee, my first congressional hearing. That hearing was on visa fraud and immigration fraud. You know, too much talk about the border, the wall on the border. That's all anyone wanted to talk about. The border with Mexico is vital. Don't misunderstand. We must secure that border. That isn't the conversation. But it's only one hole out of many in a very big colander that we use to drain pasta. In fact, I write for Front Page Magazine. And one of the articles that I wrote early on when I started writing for them, I gave it the clear title, Border Security and the Immigration Colander. We had been sold for many years this false story, this false promise, that if we could only secure that magical Mexican border, the immigration crisis would be over. That is one of the biggest lies in the world. There were so many lies. George W. Bush, globalist, who created DHS, an agency that was so thoroughly screwed up, I came to call it the Department of Homeland Surrender, not the Department of Homeland Security, was running around, if you remember, offering to make the immigrants legal. He was following lockstep with Jimmy Carter's false language. Language is significant, and this is not about political correctness. This is Orwellian. This is Orwellian. Using false language to modify people's understandings of critical issues. So when George Bush came out and said, we're going to make the immigrants legal, I had countered that by saying that offering to make immigrants legal makes as much sense as offering to make water wet. Water is wet, and the immigrants are illegal. He was talking about legalizing illegal aliens. World of difference. And the way they structured the Department of Homeland Security, they tore immigration into multiple agencies. put people from customs primarily in charge of it. They had no background or inclination to enforce immigration law, and it was disastrous. In fact, I testified at a hearing 44 months after 9/11, May 5th, I believe it was, 2005, about the dual missions of the immigration component of DHS. And part of what happened there goes back to the advice I had given Congress at other hearings, where I said we've got to spin off enforcement from the benefit side, the people that determine who gets green card, citizenship, political asylum, because those are two very conflicting issues, and we've got to separate them. There needs to be a clear purpose in what we're doing, and I recommended giving this new agency that I had recommended they create the title of the Bureau of Immigration Enforcement, BIE. And I said, if you do that, that name is clear to the employees, and it's equally clear to the public that this is an agency who has an enforcement mission. This is about deterrence through enforcement. And we thought that it was going to go that way, and along comes George W. Bush and says, nope, we're going to do things very differently. And at that hearing, John Hostetler, who chaired the committee, and he's a Republican, talked about how the way that the Bush administration put DHS together made it impossible to secure our borders, enforce our immigration laws, protect America, and protect Americans. Again, both sides of the aisle bear the responsibility. And I was astonished because when I walked out of the hearing, and I was very upset because they were talking about how they were still working on mission statements 44 months after 9/11, still trying to decide what the priorities for immigration enforcement was going to be 44 months after 9/11. And in fact, I was called to that hearing by the Republicans because they were angry that they had given the president, President George W. Bush, enough money to hire 800 new ICE agents and 2,000 more Border Patrol agents, which I thought were very low numbers. And Bush turns around and says, oh no, forget 800 ICE agents, 143. I'll never forget the numbers. Forget 2,000 more Border Patrol agents. We're going to cut that to 210. So with that for the backdrop, I was enraged at the hearing. And when I walked out of the hearing, suddenly it dawned on me, and I was sorry that it hadn't dawned on me while I was sitting in front of the microphones in front of the members of the committee, subcommittee. 44 months is a magic number, and it may not be occurring to anybody listening to me right now, but take a deep breath and think of this analogy. On December 7th, 1941, the entire Japanese fleet inflicted fewer casualties on America than did the 19 terrorists, young men barely out of their teens, on 9/11/2001. It took 44 months for the United States, with its allies, to defeat the Nazis and make the world safe for democracy. 44 months. 44 months after the worst terror attack in the United States, they were still screwing around with mission statements and priorities. How's that for an interesting perspective? Does that frame it for you?
Clearly. And if it doesn't for anyone else, I don't know what to say. Yeah.
But so you know, and that's what I try to do, is to get people to understand it. And you know, where laws are concerned, when we see law violations, what's the usual reaction? Amp up law enforcement, right?
That's right.
Drunk driving was a problem. 1.0 was often acceptable around the country as the maximum acceptable blood alcohol level, 1.0. And the carnage was horrific. As a kid, I remember I hated driving Saturday nights because you'd be on the highways of New York City and you had people doing S-turns down the road, either going 90 miles an hour or going 8 miles an hour. And the crashes we had were horrific because you had, you know, knuckleheads boozed out of their gourds, smashing into each other at high speed, and these look like plane crashes, not like car crashes. So what did they do? They said, okay, forget 1.0, we're going to make it 0.08. And now if we catch you, we're going to take your car, we're going to take your license, we're going to take your wallet, and we're going to put your rear end in jail and take your freedom. And then we're going to publicize it. And then we're going to set up sobriety checkpoints. And lo and behold, the number of people driving drunk decreased drastically. Why? Deterrence through enforcement. The IRS, before April 15th, goes out and they round up a bunch of tax cheats, people from every walk of life imaginable, school teachers, reverends, rabbis, you name it, ministers, all sorts of people, right? And why are they doing it? And they have them do the perp walk. Why? Don't you let yourself get caught, because if you do, there's consequences, right? Isn't that the tradition of what they do?
Yep. Yep.
Texting and driving. How many public service announcements? I'm convinced, you know, if I reach for that phone, SWAT will descend on my car and pull me out through my sunroof at gunpoint, right?
Yeah.
Where immigration is concerned, what do both political parties say? Well, we can't deport 11 million, so we should give them legal status. Well, first of all, there's probably 30 or 40 million. Mr. Reagan promised us 1 million. We wound up with almost 4 million.
Right.
In 2007, the Congressional Budget Office estimated there were 12 million illegals. How do you go from 12 million 10 years ago to 11 million today?
You don't.
Okay. Okay. So the numbers are bogus, just like the unemployment statistics.
Yeah. Hang on, Mr. Keller, hold that thought.
I hear the bumper music. I'll take a deep breath.
All right.
Grab a cup of coffee.
This is fascinating, folks. Michael Cutler is our guest.
Yeah, and michaelcutler.net is the website. And if it looks funny on screen, that's because during the last segment, one of our
projector blew. It sounded like a 9mm going off, and we all jumped.
Yeah, it did. That should be back up and fixed tomorrow. But Michael Cutler is our guest. michaelcutler.net is the website. He's a former INS agent, and he's talking to us about the immigration and immigration enforcement issues. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Stay with us.
Visit HagmanReport.com for the news and articles that matter most. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
There shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. No, nor ever shall be.
Folks, I'm going to direct your attention to MasterPreps.com. MasterPreps.com. Wow. MasterPreps.com, the sponsor of our show, MasterPreps.com. That's MasterPreps.com. Take a visit there. High-quality items, made-in-America items. I mean, anything, everything you possibly want, from cooking utensils, cooking frying pans. It'll blow you away. Absolutely, Eric's a...
It's insane. I mean, wow. Look at the products.
Folks, visit MasterPreps.com. Again, welcome to the Hagman and Hagman Report family. MasterPreps.com. I mean, wow. It's insane.
MasterPreps.com. Are you ready for what comes next?
New Year from all of us at Trading Post in the Woods.
We pray you have a healthy, safe, and prosperous 2017.
And we would like to thank all of you for welcoming us to the Hagman and Hagman family. You're all a very wonderful and special group of people.
Because we believe it is so important for you to work and acquire good health this year, we're going to do something that we've never done before as a thank you to you for your support. We're going to make something available that we believe everyone needs.
During the month of January, anyone who invests in their health by purchasing either our American Heritage Remedies Kit, our Survivalist Natural Remedies Kit, or $200 in individual remedies of your choice, we're going to give to you our crisis remedy, just in case, for free. Your health must be a part of your preparation plan. We're here to help you with that journey. May God bless y'all, and may God bless America.
Happy New Year!
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Charles, the guy whose voice is heard announcing for the Hagman and Hagman Report right here on YouTube and across the Global Star Radio Network. There have been many people wondering whose music is being played during those breaks. Well, you guessed it. And we're very pleased to announce that all that music and 11 brand new songs from the CD New Jerusalem is set for release on April 10th for download on iTunes. means you can help support my ministry and be blessed by this awesome, inspiring recording. I have been fortunate to work with some phenomenal musicians from around the world that helped us put this recording together in the studio. Simply go to joecharlesmusic.com and click on the iTunes link. Or, if you'd rather have a CD, we'll send one right out to you. Just leave me your email and we'll get right back to you. And thanks to Doug and Joe Hagman for making this all possible. God bless.
Welcome back, folks, to the Hagman Reporter. Very special guest, Mr. Michael Cutler. MichaelCutler.net. Man on a mission. Indeed he is.
Well, you know, during the break, I was just explaining to the folks in the studio, I got caught up in doing all that I've been doing since 9/11 because on 9/11, and I had, by the way, had an argument. Besides the fact I had testified 4.5 years earlier about the nexus between immigration fraud, visa fraud, and terrorism, and the threat of terrorism because of the 293 terrorist attacks. You know, most people may have forgotten this, but January of 93, a Pakistani national by the name of Amil Mir Kansi shot up the CIA, killed 2 CIA officers, wounded 3 others, and fled the country. And in order to get into the compound, he bought into a courier service. You know, courier vans are as ubiquitous as yellow taxi cabs in midtown Manhattan. And so this one cold January morning, he pulls into the parking lot of the CIA compound, because he had a permit to go past the gates, jumped out of the van with an AK-47 and opened fire. And as all foreign nationals who commit crimes in America can do, he availed himself of that escape hatch known as leaving the country. Except in his case, our guys tracked him down like the dog that he was, dragged him back here. We put him on trial, found him guilty, and executed him. But it didn't bring back the dead or fix the wounds of those he had crippled. And 1 month later, we had the first bombing at the World Trade Center. 6 people dead, over 1,000 people injured, over a half billion, with a B, in damages. They almost brought the tower down sideways. I don't even want to imagine what the casualty count would have been. And what was so remarkable, I was home on sick leave when that happened. I was watching TV, and the TV went out, because the cables got severed, and we had the broadcast towers on top of the Trade Center. And within a week or so, I remember walking through midtown Manhattan, or downtown Manhattan, rather, and I bumped into a bunch of my buddies. I was with the drug task force, so I was working with everybody from everywhere. It was kind of like a game of pickup basketball, except this was pickup lunch. And we wound up going to one of those marvelous Irish pubs in lower Manhattan. And the folks there, the owners, recognized us for being law enforcement. They said, "What do you want? We'll give it to you. We'll give you the check, and we'll get out of your way so you guys can have a meeting. We have a sense you want privacy," and we did. So they gave us, you know, a mountain of burgers. We paid our bill, and then we just sat there for a couple of hours behind the closed door. And everybody in that room, ATF, FBI, DEA, New York City Police, New York State Police, everybody was convinced that this was the watershed moment for immigration. It was obvious to everybody that it was a failure of immigration that enabled those dirtbags into the country, enabled them to carry out that deadly attack, and only but for the grace of God, we didn't have a couple of 100,000 dead bodies. I mean, if they had blown out the what was called the bathtub, the seawall that kept the Hudson River out of lower Manhattan, Canal Street might have really had a new meaning. And so this was unbelievable. And the Clinton administration did absolutely nothing in response to this horrific terrorist attack. It literally and figuratively left the door open to that which followed. But I remember sitting there during that lunch, and I said to the guys at the table, I said, if I had a magic wand that can make all the criminal aliens in New York vanish, what would you be focused on? And I don't remember if it was the FBI agent or the ATF agent, because they both chimed in. But the two responses were, one, I'll be working on my golf swing because it stinks. And the other one said that he had a back deck that needed to be replaced. They both opined that without criminal aliens in New York, there'd be very little work for anybody to do in law enforcement. That's how significant the impact is.
Yeah.
When you drive down Roosevelt Avenue in Jackson Heights, Queens, it used to be controlled by the Colombians. The Mexicans have taken over the drug trade. And what may have gone unnoticed by many people is that El Chapo Guzman, the most notorious of all Mexican drug cartel leaders, has been brought to the United States and was arraigned in the Eastern District of New York because of his drug trafficking activities in Queens. The drugs are coming across from Arizona, and they're being distributed throughout the United States. And if you go through Roosevelt Avenue, every single block has one money wire remitter after another, the money wire services, whether it's Western Union, whether it's Brand X, whether it's the travel agencies, they're all moving money on a scale that nobody could begin to comprehend. The money is paying for the cartels, the money is winding up in the hands of terrorists, and the money is damaging, destroying our economy, and the drugs are killing our children and their future. It's behind most of our violent crime. So if you understand that, and you understand that heroin is not produced in the United States, heroin is purely produced outside the United States, whether it's produced in Mexico, the Middle East, or Asia, it's imported, it's smuggled. Every single gram of heroin present in the United States provides graphic, irrefutable evidence of a failure of border security. So when Mr. Obama would lie through his teeth and say the border is secure, and I can never forget that news conference in El Paso. Well, the other side are going to want the moat, and then they're going to want alligators in the moat. Well, I went to El Paso. I worked with a law firm on a case down there. This is a dangerous part of the country. And if you want to know how porous our borders are, understand that the demand for heroin, in part because of the opiates being used as painkillers by doctors and so forth, have hooked people on heroin, opiates. And heroin is a lot cheaper than prescription drugs. So the demand for heroin has gone through not the roof, but the stratosphere. And under economic principles, when the demand goes through the stratosphere, the price goes through the stratosphere, but not with heroin. The price of heroin has never, ever been cheaper than it is today. The only way that heroin could be dirt cheap with the demand in the stratosphere is that if there is a limitless supply, we have a limitless supply, and it all comes from outside the United States. It's coming across the Mexican border. It's coming in ships. It's coming through international airport and cargo holds of airplanes, and it's coming across the Canadian border. We are awash in heroin. And the only way that could happen is if our borders are not secure. And along comes Donald Trump and says, we're going to secure the border. And you have people like Senator Menendez from New Jersey saying it's a wall of hate. It's going to stop trade. So let's take a deep breath and think about what Donald Trump is talking about. The wall that he will build is not going to go across ports of entry. It's just going to make certain that people and goods move through ports of entry. How is that a wall of hate? You see? But this is the language of the other side. And unfortunately, the other side isn't about Democrat or Republican. John McCain, Lindsey Graham are no better, and they're supposedly Republicans. You know, I'm a lifelong Democrat. I'm a labor guy. My father was a construction worker. My father and my mother are my biggest heroes. My dad was a tradesman, as he liked to say, a plumber who did construction work, not repair work. He worked on the World's Fair. I used to hang out on construction sites. When I listen to Donald Trump, I hear the voice of the men my father worked with and worked for when I was a kid. I literally carried my dad off his job his last day of work when I was 19 and he was 57, in part because he smoked Chesterfield blowtorches and I hated them, but also because he worked in the Navy shipyards during the Second World War because he had to contribute to the war effort. His brother was in the Army Air Corps, and because of the tragedy of the five Sullivan brothers killed on a Navy ship, my father, a sole member of the family, male member of the family, could not enlist in the military because his brother was there. So his reaction was, I've got to defend America. He really wanted to go overseas and kill Nazis, didn't have that opportunity, so he had to help the war machinery by working in the shipyards. And my mother came here ahead of the Holocaust. Her mother was killed in Poland because we're Jews. I was named for my mother's mother. So, you know, first of all, I want to make it clear, I'm not anti-immigrant, but I am pro-enforcement. These are the lies that are told. When I was an immigration inspector, I prevented bad guys from entering the United States, but I let many more in than I kept out, and I was happy to do it. I admitted refugees who had been vetted, and even if we screwed up, those refugees would not have posed a threat to American lives. if we screwed up, nobody was getting killed by the mistakes. Today we are. I admitted foreign students. I admitted new immigrants from all over the world. I was happy to do it. I admitted tourists and try to make the experience one of welcoming and make it as pleasant as I could. When I was an immigration examiner and adjudications officer, I uncovered a marriage fraud ring that involved, believe it or not, only in New York. Well, I guess I couldn't say that. It probably would happen elsewhere. But we had Chinese crewmen getting married to Puerto Rican lesbian hookers. I kid you not.
Oh, that's
and
good.
It wound up with my first stint on the witness stand in federal court. But, of course, I can't tell you how many more times I wound up on the witness stand, but I was a new kid on the block then. But I also authorized green cards for hundreds of new immigrants, and I was happy to see them get their lawful status. See, this isn't about being opposed to immigration. It's about being opposed to illegal immigration and making certain that the system has integrity. So let me just read one more thing to you. If you want to talk about integrity, this is on page 47 of that 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. Once terrorists had entered the United States, their next challenge was to find a way to remain here. Their primary method was immigration fraud. For example, Yusuf and Ajaj concocted bogus political asylum stories when they arrived in the United States. Mahmoud Abu Alima, involved in both the World Trade Center and Landmark plots, received temporary residence under the Seasonal Agriculture Worker Program after falsely claiming that he picked beans in Florida. The only thing in point of fact, folks, that he planted was that bomb in the garage of the Trade Center. And then we get to page 98, and this is so crystal clear. And think of the politicians from both parties insisting that we're going to legalize these people. And the only debate is, do we give them citizenship or not? They don't need citizenship, they just need lawful status. Because listen to this paragraph. As I said to Jim Sensenbrenner when he chaired the House Judiciary Committee, I said, Mr. Chairman, if I can't sleep at night, sure as hell I'm not going to let you sleep at night either. Share my pain. Terrorists in the 1990s, as well as the September 11th hijackers, needed to find a way to stay in or embed themselves in the United States if their operational plans were to come to fruition. As already discussed, this could be accomplished legally by marrying an American citizen, achieving temporary worker status. Think of those hundreds of thousands of dreamers, folks. It can be as old as 31, or applying for asylum after entering. In many cases, the act of filing for an immigration benefit suffice to permit the alien to remain in the country until the petition was adjudicated. Terrorists were free to conduct surveillance, coordinate operations, obtain and receive funding, go to school and learn English, make contacts in the United States, acquire necessary materials, and execute an attack. Is there any ambiguity to what I just read to you?
None at all. No.
Then how can you, as a member of Congress, how can you, as a president of the United States, be an advocate for providing unknown millions of illegal aliens who entered the United States surreptitiously with lawful status? They evaded the inspections process. The open borders immigration anarchists refer to them as undocumented. In point of fact, what they are was entrance without inspection, the inspection process that was designed to keep out terrorists, criminals, aliens with dangerous diseases, and so forth. So it's not that they're undocumented, although, you know, if you want to say that, then you could say that you can't tell a good guy from a bad guy without a scorecard. Undocumented means they have no scorecard, but these folks were uninspected. Or you have the aliens like the terrorists who violated the terms of their visas or committed visa fraud to enter the United States. Along comes Donald Trump and says, we've got to do something about it. So he comes up with an executive order, and we saw where the courts knocked it down, and they're lining up to sue him again, even though they changed it. And Jeff Sessions is, I think, a brilliant prosecutor. I had the privilege, because in 2007, I believe it was, I had testified before three House hearings and one Senate hearing about comprehensive immigration reform, and I was so frustrated, I decided that that ill-conceived legislation needed a new and more honest and descriptive name. So I wrote an op-ed for the Washington Times, and I came to refer to comprehensive immigration reform as being the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act. Senator Sessions liked my article so much, he quoted me from the floor of the United States Senate with attribution on three separate occasions, and then sent me a certificate commemorating it. In fact, one of the 9/11 family members, my good friend Bruce DeSalle, who was a former New York City cop, and his son-in-law, the son of a fire battalion chief in New York, was killed on 9/11. And Bruce called me up. I was sitting in my car, and he said, Mike, quick, put the TV on. Sessions is on the floor of the Senate. And I said, Bruce, I'm sitting in my car. So he held his phone next to his TV, because it was on C-SPAN. And I got to tell you, it was quite a moment sitting in my car in Brooklyn, listening to a United States senator quoting me by name and telling the other members of the Senate, you must listen to what Mr. Cutler, a former INS senior special agent, has to say. And then he quoted that expression, that phrase, the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act. My wife got in the car, and we were having arguments about the wisdom of all the things I was doing up until that day. And she got in the car and said, wow, you have a weird look on your face. Are you okay? I said, you mean I look weirder than usual? And we had our usual laugh about it. And I said, Senator Sessions just quoted me. She said, are you serious? I said, yes. And 2 days later, a package arrives in the mail. Her eyes were the size of silver dollars. She ran to a local store and had it framed. It's hanging in my bedroom. I'm staring at it right now because my desk where I do my work is in the bedroom. And that's something that I look at every morning as encouragement that we can make a difference. So, of course, Sessions is evil incarnate to the anarchists who don't want our borders secured, who don't want to stop the flow of illegal aliens, and the news media won't cover the story. Because here's something that nobody is telling you. If you want to talk about an unintended consequence, I want everyone to stop and think about this. If, let's say, the same kind of ratio happens that we saw with Reagan. We were told about 1 million. We wind up with nearly 4 million. We're being told 11 million. We could wind up with, what, 30 or 40 million. Think of that number. Many of them aren't even here yet. The talking heads on TV. Well, if an alien's been living in the United States for 7 years, 8 years, 9 years, 5 years, pick a number out of the hat, and they haven't been arrested, of course we should let them stay. No one ever stops them and says, well, wait a minute. You're dealing with millions upon millions, tens of millions of people. There won't be any interviews. There won't be any field investigations. They won't be able to run the bureaucratic machinery fast enough to keep up. And it only takes about 30 minutes to approve an application. It takes days or weeks to deny an application because you need legal sufficiency. You've got to write a report. You've got to write an official denial. Attorneys have to check it for legal sufficiency in anticipation of a challenge, of an appeal. So understand that almost every application gets approved. Terrorists would easily slip through, as we saw with the 93 bombing. But here's the other part. Besides the irrevocable damage it would do to national security, every single last one of all of those illegal aliens would immediately, upon being granted lawful status, have the absolute right to petition the government to immediately, within whatever, a day or two, bring every single one of their minor children and their spouses to the United States.
Nice.
30 million aliens, and now let's say only one in three has kids. We'll be optimistic. But most of the people that I arrested, when you ask them how many children they have, they puff out their chest and they will tell you, 8 that I know of, 6 that I know of, and they laugh. What happens when we wind up with more kids coming into America than the number of aliens we legalize, and then we immediately put them into our school systems that are crumbling as we speak? What happens when you look at that Congressional Budget Office report from 2007 that estimated that it costs 20 to 40% more to educate a child who can't speak English? What happens if among that population, as we saw with that a wave of unaccompanied minors, and there was a hearing in April of last year before the House Immigration Subcommittee conducted by Trey Gowdy, and I've spoken with Trey a number of times. I think he's really trying to do the right thing, and I appreciate the prosecutor that he is. And they had this hearing where a sheriff from Maryland said that since those unaccompanied minors came into the country from Central America, in Maryland, his deputies, when they get called out because of a crime of violence committed in the schools, over 60% of the time, I think it was 62 or 63% of the time, it involves one of those unaccompanied minors who's part of a gang committing crimes of violence in the schools. So understand that any kind of a massive legalization program would be catastrophic to our educational system, to health care, criminal justice. People coming in perhaps haven't been inoculated, might be bringing with them dangerous diseases. If you go through the categories of aliens to be excluded from the United States, Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182 is very clear on that. It's an important section of law for another reason that I will get to in about 30 seconds. But it includes aliens with dangerous communicable diseases. Ellis Island was, after all, a quarantine station. Aliens who suffer severe mental illness. Aliens who are criminals, spies, terrorists, human rights violators, war criminals, fugitives from justice, prior deportees, and then we get to aliens who would likely become a public charge or, if they work, would displace American workers. Now, Section F of that section of law, and this is really critical because we're hearing all the screaming about how what Trump is doing is so unfair by saying he's going to keep people out of countries that might pose a threat to our safety. And every newspaper and every television program in America, mainstream media, refers to those six countries as Muslim-majority countries, but that's not why they're on the list. They are on the list because they are essentially failed states and they have a clear nexus to terrorism if they aren't out-and-out supporters of terrorism, as is the case with Iran. And it's remarkable because on February the 24th, 1998, 2 days short of the fifth anniversary of the Trade Center bombing, we had a senator at a hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The hearing was on foreign terrorists operating in the United States, and she said that there were three things she thought we might want to consider doing. Number one, end the visa waiver program. It was a pilot program then. The other point, she said, is maybe we should stop giving visas to countries to the citizens of countries that sponsor terrorism. And finally, she said, we certainly should be reconsidering whether we should allow students from those countries that sponsor terrorism to study nuclear physics and biochemistry in the United States because we're teaching them to make weapons of mass destruction. This right-wing lunatic senator, this extreme nutcase, was Dianne Feinstein. And it made perfect sense. And the reason that we've gone from 26 visa waiver countries on 9/11 and should have zero now, but we have 38, many were added by George W. Bush, by the way, is because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce started a program known as the Discover America Partnership. They've partnered with the hotel, hospitality, and travel industries. They are dumping God knows how many tens of millions of dollars into political campaign coffers from both sides of the aisle, pushing the elimination of visa requirements. I guess they're promoting business for the funeral home industry also. And how reassuring is it to know that people responsible for clean linen and room service are now making national security decisions? But when people talk about what the president is doing and how he's acting outside the law, Section F of 1182 says this, and it's a short sentence. And notice, this says the president alone. Whenever the president finds that the entry of any aliens or of any class of aliens into the United States would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. Think of what a low bar that is, detrimental to the interests. Doesn't need to have an atom bomb strapped to his back, doesn't have to have the Ebola virus. The president looks and says, you know what, this is detrimental. The president may, by proclamation and for such period as he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions that he may deem to be appropriate. So where's the beef? And by the way, if you want to talk about, if you want to talk about constitutionality, then why don't we consider Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution, which reads, "The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government, and shall protect each of them against invasion. And on application of the legislature or of the executive, when the legislature cannot be convened, against domestic violence." Is that not what the president is now trying to do? Lost my mind, guys?
We're about 4 minutes out. You got the floor for the rest of the 4 minutes. This is fascinating. Yeah. It's important information.
Well, you know, as I say, since 9/11, I've been a man on a mission. But, folks, if this fires you up, you need to be involved. I will tell you, if you have children or grandchildren and you are not involved in politics, and I don't mean taking to the streets like the wackaloons, I'm not talking about a mobocracy, but I am talking about going to town hall meetings and questioning your elected representatives to make certain that they truly represent you. If you're not doing this, you're not doing your job as a parent. Because the decisions being made by our politicians on all level of government, you look at sanctuary cities, there's nothing sanctuary about it. They're only protecting the bad guys and endangering national security and the safety of the people within those municipalities and neighboring municipalities, because they can use those sanctuary cities as staging areas. If you allow this to happen and you don't voice the obverse viewpoint, shame on you, because you're hurting all of us. My father taught me that I should teach people how they would treat me by demonstrating what I was willing to accept. And when we say nothing, the presumption is made that the foolish Americans are sitting back and they don't notice or they don't care. The politicians want to win re-election. They are scared to death of having to have an honest job, in more ways than one, an honest job. You see? When you contrast the politicians with a guy like Homer Hickam, who wrote the book Rocket Boy that became the screenplay October Sky, a movie every kid should have to see. He grew up in Colwood. His father was a coal miner. He delivered the eulogy at the Stago mine disaster. He became a NASA engineer. An amazing life story. And he spoke at the eulogy when that mine disaster occurred a decade ago and said something that brought tears to my eyes, because he made me think of my father and his buddies. He said, "There's no water holier than the sweat off a man's brow." Contrast that with these politicians. Shame on us for reelecting any politician who could talk about the work an American won't do, or the need to bring in the world's best and brightest, like Ted Cruz did during the campaign, when the world's best and brightest are called Americans. Don't tell me about American exceptionalism and then tell me you want to bring in the world's best and brightest. It's Americans who went to the moon, Americans who built the Panama Canal, Americans who broke the sound barrier, and Americans who sent space probes past the solar system. So when I hear this nonsense, I don't blame the politicians. I blame we, the people, because we're lousy employers. And I hope that everybody out there will check out my website. It's Michael Cutler, C-U-T-L-E-R, one word, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. I write for capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, Californians for Population Stabilization. Very happy to be a columnist for David Horowitz Freedom Center. That publication is frontpagemag.com. I also write for The Social Contract, and I'm thrilled to go on radio programs or do public speaking events, because this is about conveying the truth. The First Amendment speaks not only about freedom of press, speech, and religion, but the right for peaceable assemblage and the right to petition the government for grievances. Folks, if you don't have grievances, you better check for a flatline EEG. And yeah. I always like to make the point that democracy is not a spectator sport, so I urge everyone to get involved.
Yeah, you timed that just right. Your message was on point, and just wow. And I want to thank Ocasio Media. Thank you so much for arranging this interview. Michael Cutler, thank you so much for your time. I know you've testified before committees, Senate, you've been on every television
display of hearings and every place else. Yeah, I've been a man on a mission 9/11.
And thank you for all of your information.
Well, thank you. Thank you for providing me with the opportunity to speak to your terrific audience. I hope to get involved.
Amen, brother. Until next time. And we do hope you'll come back. And it's been fascinating. Thank you so very much. God bless you, my friend.
Be well, guys. Thank you. You as well. Have a wonderful evening.
All right. You too. That'll do it for us, folks. The Hagman Report, Hagman and Hagman.com, HagmanReport.com. Michael Cutler, the former INS agent. MichaelCutler.net. He is a man on a mission, let me tell you. And wow, it's fascinating. We're without a backdrop. The projector
blew up mid show.
Yeah, sound like a 9mm going off. We all ducked.
Don't forget tomorrow, Steve Quayle will be with us in hours 2 and 3. It's going to be a great show. So until then, stay safe. God bless. Have a great night.